What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Jasmine Holmes. So this book that Jasmine has written, it's called Mother to Son. It comes out a week from today, and it's one that I've had on my list of like must reads since I saw it come out in IVP's, you know, book list. It just looks like an amazing book. It's letters from Jasmine written to her son, but in it, she gets into such amazing territory in this book. It's incredible the places she travels in this book and the things she gets to talk about to her son. It really is a beautiful book. And in this episode, we talk about her journey to becoming a mother. She is very passionate about motherhood and pregnancy and the female body and that sort of thing. And so we talk about that. I actually probably unveil my strangest job really ever in this episode. So look out for that here. We also talk about racism because Jasmine is really open about, you know, her beautiful baby son now is going to grow up and be a very large black man someday, and how that affects her as a mother and how she thinks through it. And even, you know, as he's a toddler, how she navigates some of that stuff. So we have this really impactful discussion about racism and the racism that she has experienced. And we travel all over the place in this episode, and there is such good stuff. I can't wait for you to hear from Jasmine. She is so well read and like talks about a lot of these authors that we should be reading. I have extensive notes in the podcast episode, and just her love of literature, I think, is sort of infectious in this episode. And so we talk about all those things, and you're going to love hearing from her. So I just want to encourage you before we get to this episode to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, so you can stay up to date with what we got going on the podcast. And yeah, I hope everybody's staying safe out there, and I can't wait for you to hear from Jasmine. Well, Jasmine, I can't say thanks enough for coming on the podcast and chatting with me. I'm excited.
Thank you for having me.
For sure. Let's jump off and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everyone.
Okay, cool. My name is Jasmine Holmes, and I live in Jackson, Mississippi with my husband, Philip. And my two boys, Walter Wynn is 3.5 and Langston just turned 1. I'm a writer. I'm an 8th grade teacher, and I'm a pastor's kid.
I love it. That's good. That's a nice work. That's very concise and
all the high points.
you nailed it. You nailed it. Okay. Let's walk through a little bit of your life then, from sort of being a pastor's kid. 'Cause I know you sort of grew up in, Texas and, have sort of gone all over the place. So do you mind just walking through your story just a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and my dad was always a pastor my entire childhood. We did a short stint in Oxford in the UK while he was, studying for his graduate degree, came back to Texas, and lived there until I met my husband, Philip. We got married in Texas. We actually met at a conference. So he's from Mississippi and was living in Mississippi when we met. We ended up living in Texas for the first 8-9 months. We moved to Minneapolis. My husband got a job there. And then we moved back home to Mississippi.
Okay. Yeah. Minnesota is ruthless, cold wise. I mean, you're from like Houston area, right?
Yes. Yeah. It actually, so I was pregnant with my son most of the time that we lived in Minnesota. So I was hot like the entire winter, and I was teaching upper school writing. So I had 115 writing students from 7th grade up to seniors, and I made them shiver in the cold because I would open my windows in the middle of Minnesota winter. But I was like, I'm hot. I'm hormonal. Just shut up. Just put your jacket on.
I love it. That's good. That's good stuff. So vocationally then, you're a teacher. Like, how did all that sort of, go down?
Yeah. So growing up, I wanted to be a literature professor when I grew up. That's like, if you had asked me, dorky 11-year-old Jasmine, what she wanted to be, I would have been like, I'm going to teach English at university. And I don't have enough degrees to do that. But I do teach English and history to 8th graders, and ended up being able to be a writer too, which is another, it's cool. It's the things that I wanted to do when I was a kid, I'm getting to do now. So that's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. Because you talk about the role like history has even played in your personal life, right? In addition, and like your life, I mean, from what you say in the book, your life sort of revolves around history, and like history has sort of changed the way you think and in a lot of different ways.
That's so true. It's so funny. I was an English major in college. My dad told me that I should be a history major because I've always loved history, and I didn't want him to tell me what to do. So I did English. But it's so interesting because the more that I learn about history and the way that it impacts our ideas and our thought processes and just the structure of our society, the more I really appreciate it. I love history, and I love teaching it, and I love writing about it too.
Yeah. That's awesome. So what is it about literature then? Because I think we'll get into history too as we move along. But what is it about literature? Like, what are the works that sort of like maybe sparked your like literature, you know, your desire to teach and like learn literature?
So Mildred D. Taylor, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, which is the typical Black girl answer, but that's because it is just universally true. Okay. And Langston Hughes poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate I appreciate you talking about Langston Hughes a lot, because obviously you have a Langston, right? I mean,
I do.
Yes, very formative. So what is it about Langston Hughes that sort of like captures your imagination?
Oh my goodness, I could go on, and I kind of do in the book a little bit. Somebody asked
I thought like, it was just enough.
Like, if I'm going to read one poem by Langston Hughes, like, what should I read? And I gave her like 10. Yeah. But I just remember, so when I was growing up, we had a big, like a Langston Hughes anthology in our library, and it sat there forever, like books do. We just had a house full of books. And one day I just kind of like stumbled upon it, and I read it, and I read the entire thing in a matter of days, because there's something about the rhythm of Langston Hughes poetry that just like seeps deep, deep, deep into your skin, into your soul. Like he captures so many huge and vast emotions in such a short amount of space, in such a short amount of words. I love, goodness, it's hard to narrow down a favorite one.
You can give me a few. I mean, if that's okay.
Yeah, so Mother to Son, obviously. And that's why my book is called Mother to Son. And then The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I love that one. And that goes back to history, because it's talking all about, I mean, really, it's Black history put in a beautiful lyrical poem. I like Harlem. I love the way he talks about Black women and their beauty in that poem. I Choose Sing America, again, the history element. And I love that Langston is always I won't say it's always a silent protest, right? Because it's not always silent. But even when he's talking about joy, it's this protesting joy in the face of suffering. Like, he is undaunted, even though he stares suffering in the face. And I love that about him.
That's beautiful. I love that. Okay. So I've just been reading a book about Arthur Briggs, who was a jazz trumpeter back at the 20s. And he actually like used to hang out with Langston Hughes in France, at a club, it was like,
yeah.
It's crazy how all those like figures sort of like mesh together. And, Arthur Briggs was like not going back to America basically because of the rampant racism that he found there. You know, I mean, it's mind boggling. So
it's a crazy time in history for sure.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's all cool. Those great minds all together.
Yeah. Right. And just like hanging out in a club. Right. I mean, it's not like they're, they're not like smoking pipes and sitting around and like having theological discussions. It's like, we're just chilling,
hanging out. Because you think like maybe it was like a conference that brought them all together, an event, but like, no, they're just like every day, like, oh, Zora Neale Hurston is over there and Claude McKay is over there. Like just casual.
It's no big deal. It's amazing. That's pretty cool. Okay. So, let's talk Mother to Son then. Where did the like idea and all, why write the book?
So I have, like I said, I've been a writer for a long time. I wrote my first, I'm putting novel in air quotes, when I was like 9 years old. I wonder if my mom still has it. It was like handwritten, of course, and so depressing. Like literally everybody in the story died, like at the end of the novel, and the narrator is like, and then I lay down in the snow and I die. I'm like, so from 9 years old, I was like, I'm going to be a novelist. I'm going to write fiction. It's going to be amazing, because the people that inspired me have always been fiction authors and essayists. And so when I, of course, became an adult, and writing fiction feels a little bit more vulnerable in your 20s than it does as a child.
Sure.
So I usually write a lot of nonfiction publicly, but I still read a lot of fiction and was inspired and informed by a lot of fiction. So there was a season in my life where I was reading James Baldwin and Chimamanda Adichie, like nonstop Chimamanda Adichie. I read Americana. I read Half of a Yellow Sun. I read We Should All Be Feminists. But the one that really stuck out to me was Letters to Iyajawile, which is her letters to her goddaughter. And it's a feminist manifesto, but it's written in the form of letters to her goddaughter. So I read that. And then super randomly, I was teaching my class about civil rights movement. And I had read James Baldwin as a teenager. I read Go Tell It on the Mountain, but I had never read The Fire Next Time. So I read Letters to Iyajawile and The Fire Next Time, like back to back. And The Fire Next Time is, of course, Baldwin's letters to his nephew. So the idea of letters kind of had stuck in my brain. And when IVP approached me to see if I had any ideas for writing, because I've been writing a lot, talking a lot to editors, and I thought I was going to write a book about womanhood. But then when I got the email, I was like, I don't know if I'm ready to write a book about womanhood. I don't know if I'm ready to get into that. And I was talking to my mentor, Karen Ellis, who is a phenomenal author and theologian in her own right. And she said, you should use your Winspiration. And that's my son's name, Win. And she was like, what if you wrote letters to your son? It could be about anything. And when she said that, everything just kind of crystallized together. And literally in one day, I rattled off an email and was like, this is what I want to do. I think that it would be really an amazing thing for me to write for myself, for my sons, and hopefully it would be something that would be helpful to other people too. So it all came together really fast, but it had been building for years.
Yeah, that's awesome. I loved it. I'll be honest, I didn't know what I was sort of getting myself into when I got the book, right? And like, I didn't realize the deep waters into which I was wading. It was surprising, I'll say, because you never think about this sort of wisdom that a parent shares with a child, you know? And we live in such a culture sort of disconnected even from like ancient times, but also like the more modern times, where especially a part of specifically the African American experience is passing down like information, you know, parent to child. And of course that's true for lots of cultures, but you never realize how much like there is given from a specifically for you, from a mother, like to a son. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's been interesting because I have a lot of people think, you know, they'll ask me like, can I read it if I'm not a mother, or can I read it if I don't have a son, or can I read it if I'm not Black? Can I read it if I'm not a woman? And I always tell people that motherhood is the vehicle that I'm using to talk about these truths, but it's not the destination.
Yeah.
And I had that modeled for me so well in Adichie and Baldwin's work, because I don't have a nephew, but James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time blew me away. And it was because him talking to his nephew gave his message such a different tone, such a warmer and more familiar feel. And it was disarming. And when I read it to my students, who I didn't have any Black students in my class at the time. And we were learning about civil rights in Mississippi with their Black teacher. And so it was just an interesting experience.
That is, yeah.
It was fun. But they read it and it impacted them. And I don't think that it would have been impactful in the exact same way if it hadn't been Baldwin's letters to somebody who he loved.
Yeah, very much so. And you experience that, I think, reading your book as well. It is, you know, there is a lot, and there's a beauty to it, like in the way that you express these emotions to your son, and obviously get into so many huge topics, like in such a, you know, such a small amount of time, even, you know. Book's a really easy read, but it covers a lot of very important sort of stuff. So
Yeah, it was so intimidating. My editor, we sat down for our first meeting after I had written the rough draft, and she said, okay, these are the changes that I think we should make. This is the track that I think that we're on. And she was like, just so you know, it is this type of literature requires a very high level of writing talent and a very captivating level of prose. So bring your A game.
So good luck with that. Like,
okay. Let's go. Make 9-year-old Jasmine proud.
Yeah, right. Well, you know. I feel like as long as everybody doesn't die, you're probably okay, right? Like, good, that's at least like a, that's at least like a next Take step, next. Right?
Yes, yeah, right. Yes, yeah, for sure.
But it, I mean, it does it, you know, because it kind of constantly needs to be like bringing you back into it. Yeah, I can see that being very intimidating read to write. So, yeah, there's so many things I want to talk about with you. The first thing is the way you open the book and you introduce a concept that I think many people don't even think about, which is John 1 and Mary being the mother of Jesus. I mean, there's thousands of pages of theological literature written in that one little bit.
My goodness. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Can you talk just a little bit about just that? Yeah. Just that.
Yeah. So I'm super Protestant. And so I didn't ever put a lot of thought into Mary being the mother of Jesus growing up, because I was so used to kind of like reacting against Mary being the mother of God.
Right.
And so it's just like, hey, like, this is what the Reformation is about. Let's be careful. But when I was pregnant with my son, I read John again. And I read John 1, and it just hit me, like, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And it goes into all of this detail about how he was made wrapped in flesh, and having experienced miscarriage and loss in between the births of my healthy sons, just realizing how small and vulnerable human life is at its conception, and the fact that the God of the entire universe, who breathed everything into existence, became this tiny, vulnerable human being and went through this process that so many people have gone through and struggled through and suffered through in order to be born. Like, he elevates womanhood and pregnancy and motherhood just by submitting himself to that process. Mm. And it blew me away. It blew my Protestant self away, for sure.
Yeah, because we don't think about that. We don't talk about that as Protestants, sort of in general, right? It's like the Roman Catholics have that sort of thing. You know, but like, and Jesus and Mary had a similar relationship to you and your son and me and my mother. And like, she was his mom.
Yeah. Like, when he gets lost and she's like looking all over the place for him, and she finds him, and he just kind of like tells her that he's about the Father's business and like sets up that really strong boundary with her. Like, just as a mother, I'm going back and I'm reading that, and I'm like, you literally had an angel come and tell you that this precious little child who you are raising the best way you can is going to be the savior of the entire universe. So like, no pressure.
Right.
Just raise him.
Just, it's fine. You're going to.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, because even, I mean, even in early church history, there was a debate between like I remember the words, like a theotokos versus like a Christotokos, like whether Mary was a Christ bearer or a God bearer, you know? And that was like these are still like major issues, but like,
The
incarnation and God being born is like,
yes.
Unfathomable.
I love the format of the letter, because it helps me. I always say that I'm not a theologian, and then my husband's like, everybody's a theologian. Right. Like, I know, I get it. I hear you. But I wasn't ready to delve into that to the depths that it could be delved into. And so it was so helpful for me to just think, you know, I'm just sharing an observation that blew me away the same way that I would share it with my son. And that took so much pressure off of me and gave me so much freedom to invite people to kind of look at the same thing that I was looking at and just marvel at it. I mean, we have to wrestle with those questions, those important theological questions. It's so important, but I think we skip the marvel sometimes.
Well, and you touch on such an important topic that, like, the gospel is, like, understandable, right? Like, the gospel is very simple. Mm-hmm. Just like Jesus being Mary's son is simple. Like, there is so much depth to it. And, you know,
there is.
You don't have to go into all the depth in order to understand the simplicity and the beauty at the same time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's good. I just, even as I was reading again the book, it was just, it strikes me. I mean, how, like, you and your son are just, as you know, like me and my mom are just, we're knit together, like, emotionally, and we're very close, like, even in adulthood. And that's how Jesus was, you know?
I mean, he's dying on the cross and he's telling his disciple, like, take care of my mom.
Yeah. Right.
Which, like, I mean, as a mom, just, oh my gosh, like, hits you in the gut.
Yeah, totally.
He's still, you know, he was the savior of the entire world, is the savior of the entire world, rather. And he still loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So since we're on the topic of sort of motherhood, like, something you talk about in the book that's very near and dear to your heart is sort of like health, like, you know, health in childhood and like the female, body, how it changes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk just a little bit about some of that?
Yes, I am. I don't want to understate this, so I'm going to give you an example of myself.
Okay.
Every time any friends of mine get pregnant, they know that I have a stash of pregnancy tests at the $500, the 500 test kit. It's at my house. I just have it just in case. You never know.
I didn't know that was a thing. Like, they come in bulk?
The little strips. So they can come over.
Okay.
And they can take the tests.
Okay.
And I won't tell them. You know, it's our little thing, but I like to, you know, I bought them for myself, but I keep them, and everybody's like, oh, I don't, I'm like, hey, I have a bunch. Just come over. So they can come over. And if they come over and if it is positive, then I have an entire section of my library that's dedicated to books on birth and pregnancy and all kinds of things. I have friends who text me. They'll be like, I saw this weird thing on my body. Is it normal? And I'm like, you should talk to your doctor, but also this is what it is. Or I feel this kind of way. Is that normal? It could actually be this hormone. Like, I'm very invested. I listen to a birth podcast. 2 episodes come out every week. I never miss an episode. I'm very invested in birth. So I wanted to say all that instead of just saying, like, oh, I like birth.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I would love to be a doula someday. I want to wait until my boys are a little bit older so that me being gone at night during birth won't, like, disrupt their lives.
Sure. Yeah.
But I love birth. And I guess it started in college. So growing up, birth, I would always tell my mom, how come every time a group of women gets together, they're only 2 comments away from talking about childbirth? Like, what is that? And my mom was like, it's just something that we all go through, that we talk about. And I'm like, it's gross. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to think about it. We can't. And so in college, during the course of my master's degree, I did a class called Ethics in Unborn Life. Mm. And my professor let us write any paper that we wanted on the topic of ethics in unborn life. And I wanted to challenge myself. So I chose to do my paper on birth, which everybody around me was like, you hate birth. You think it's so gross. You are so scared of it. And I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to write about the history of midwifery in America. And it could be a meme, the way that I went from like, birth, whatever, drug me up and just do it, to like, your body is an amazing instrument made by God to bring forth life. And so the more that I learned about it, I, you know, got married, had my son at a birth center, really enjoyed my birth experience, and started to do a lot of research on why Black women in America historically aren't super wild about birth and birth culture and doulas and midwives. And it led me down this rabbit hole of all of this research about medical disparities in the Black community. So Black women are over 200 times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. And so much of that has to do with the history of the medical establishment and the lack of really personalized care. And Black birth workers and birth workers who are aware of these disparities, they bring those numbers down. And it was really important for me to talk about that in the book because it's something that's really important to me as a Black mother who gave birth to her second son, second born son in one of the worst states for Black women to give birth in America. It was really important to me to talk about.
No, and I find it, very helpful. I mean, it is part of that experience and, you know, there is like such a, like that disparity is just mind boggling.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I've had people, you know, and I don't think people are malicious at all. They want to make sense of it. But, you know, people will ask me like, oh, is it just because a lot of Black women live in poverty and they don't have access to healthcare? No, it doesn't matter. Your socioeconomic status does not affect those numbers. Right. And they're like, oh, it's because they're Black. I mean, that's the that's the commonality that can be found.
Right.
And people don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to, you know, especially when I'm getting ready to have a baby of my own, I don't want to believe that. But knowing that made me make some really specific decisions about my healthcare provider when I was pregnant with my second born.
Yeah. So do you mind sharing a little bit about that? Like what that meant? Like,
Yeah. So I actually, when I moved back, I kind of was just trying to see who I was going to go to. And I was in a coffee shop. And I don't remember if I talked about this in the book, but there were three women sitting at a table. Two of them were Black women. One of them was a white woman. And they were all talking about bringing breastfeeding into hospitals in Mississippi. And the rates for Black moms who breastfeed are like actually rising rapidly. And that's amazing.
That's cool.
But it's rising because women like these are having conversations about like how to make it rise. So they're talking about it and I'm eavesdropping and I am such an introvert. Like this next thing that happened is so counter to everything that I believe in and stand for. But I got up and I went over and I was like, hi, I'm a Black mom who breastfeeds.
So there, you know, a little bit about me.
Yeah. I was like, so that's cool. And they were so sweet. They gave me their cards and one of them was my doctor and she was this amazing Black woman who, like, my birth with my second born ended up being super crazy. Long story short, she like ended up doing a baseball slide under me and catching him at the last minute because she was like doing a C-section down the hall. It was nuts. And so she just like, I could not have had the birth that I had without her, but it helped so much to be able to trust her as a woman, not just because she's Black, but because she's aware of these disparities and is working consistently in our community to right the disparities and because she's part of the solution. Like I said, having Black birth workers and doctors, it brings those numbers down.
I just want to tell you a quick story about me so that you kind of understand where I'm at. But after we had our first baby, my wife's a social worker. She decided to say goodbye to social work for a little while. She started managing a cloth diaper store, right? And those are like some hippy dippy trippy sort of stuff going on there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So she had our second child, our middle son, and she needed to take time off, but they didn't have anybody to work. So I actually started picking up shifts at the cloth diaper store for her.
Wow.
It was pretty wild, to be honest with you. I knew more things about things just like breastfeeding in front of me just became very like normal. Yep. You know, this is how we talk.
Oh, especially with the cloth diaper cloth.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Totally. Oh yeah. There's no covers in that world.
No.
Which is
how dare you?
Yeah, it's it's a baby eating. I like
I know, yeah, I but, know.
Anyway, so all that to say, like, even I think we got so far into that world because our birth experience was so bad. And medical establishment just wants to push you into a C-section, you know, like everything is just like turn and burn, you know, and it's like, these are babies being born. Like, it's sad. It's really sad, to be honest with you.
So, and what's sad is that we've come such a long way from where we were, which is like, horrifying. Like my grandmother doesn't remember her birth. She had a twilight birth, which is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes.
So
I know. How do you transition from
that? I know. I'm like, all that to say, good job with all the birth stuff. I don't know. I think it's just such an important thing, you know? I think,
yeah, for sure.
I think young people, I think young people aren't educated enough when they get into this sort of thing. Like, I wish we could educate people better about these
things. For sure. I mean, it matters because it's your body and your body is going through something huge, and it's actually really empowering to understand. And that's not to say like, oh, I don't think you should get an epidural, or oh, I don't think you should. No way. You do what you need to do. This is this is a huge life changing right. circumstance. You do what you are comfortable with.
Right.
But know your options.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's powerful to know options.
It totally is. It totally is. And to be educated, you know?
Yeah.
By more than just like what the status quo is, I guess.
Totally. Totally.
So I appreciate you talking about that. That's one of the things that you can talk about in a format like this that you can't really talk about in other places. You know, it brings together a lot of things, I think.
I was just really able to talk about all the things that mattered to me.
Yeah,
because I was talking as though I'd be talking to my son.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Good stuff. I really enjoyed that part of it. Also just the gentle way in which you talked to him, it just like reminded me of, like, it just made me think about my kids a lot. And it was just like, you know, there's like something beautiful about that relationship between a parent and a child and all of that, you know? So
for sure. Yeah. For sure.
One thing you bring up a lot in the book, though, I mean, your son right now is a beautiful little black boy, a young black boy, but someday he's going to be a probably very tall black man.
Yeah, and we're tall people. Me and my husband is 6'6", and I'm about 5'8". So
yeah, so there's going to be some height there, and it's amazing how quickly little beautiful black boys turn into menacing big black men. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you an example. The other day, so I teach at a very predominantly white school in the suburbs in Mississippi. That is by design. I do that on purpose. I think that those kids are going to have so few black authority figures in their life. Yeah. And because I was raised in suburbia, there's a language that we kind of have in common sometimes. Yep. My husband, he's from rural Mississippi, and he called me Hillary Banks, and I just let him do it. Because what can you do? What can you do?
I love that so much. Oh, man. So,
like, I used to be like, no, like, shut up. And now I'm just like, whatever. Just say it. I don't care.
Just do a hair flip and walk away or something.
I know. Right? I'm like, it's fine. She's fabulous. It's fine. I can't help where I'm from. Because of that, there, even though, like, as a black woman, there's a lot of differences. There's a lot of, like, there's a lot of similarities. I was homeschooled. I was just raised in that little subculture. And, so me and my students, we get along great. Even when we talk about hard things, and it's wonderful. So my sons, actually, there's a daycare on campus. And so they come with me, and they are in two separate rooms. My toddler's in the toddler room, baby in the baby room. And so the other day I picked up my toddler from the daycare, which is like literally down the hall from where I teach. And his little teacher was like, hey, just so you know, Wynn hit one of us today when he got upset. And I was mortified, as any mother would be mortified.
Right.
And I went to the office and I asked my supervisor, everybody that I work with is a mom. And I asked my supervisor, I was like, hey, what would you do if your kid hit a teacher? She's like, well, I would talk to him and, you know, it's a developmental thing, yada, 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 yada. And she's just looking at me and she's like, what's the matter? And I said, I really don't want to put this pressure on my son, but I also, he can't be a little black boy who hits white women. That scares me.
Yeah.
And she was like, I don't think anybody's thinking of it like that. I don't think that it, and I was like, but they will. Like, it just was such a horrifying moment for me, because while the teacher side of my brain is like, it is developmental. He is not the first kid to hit a teacher in daycare. Right. He will not be the last kid. The other side of me was like, but he's the only black kid. He's the biggest kid in his class. And he's this, he's that. And I don't want my son to be seen as this volatile, emotional black boy. Same thing happened a couple of years ago in daycare. He was the first kid to start biting. And I was like, great. The only black kid in class, biting all the white kids. Right. No big deal. 2 weeks later, all the kids were writing because it's developmental and that's what kids do. But I, of course, am like being extra. And so I told my supervisor, I was like, it's so hard because when I was raised, it was just point blank told to me, look, you can't do the things that they do, those other kids, because you're not seeing the same way that they are. So you have to be extra. You have to be like a step above how they're behaving. And I understood why my parents did that. And I respect that so much. That's not what I want for my son. I want him to be able to be a kid. And it's so hard to balance those two things. And I want him to be safe and I want him to be thought well of. But I also want him to be able to be a child and make a mistake and not react even more than a white parent would react because I'm afraid for his future, but I am. So it's such a hard balancing act. And I don't do it well all the time. And part of the reason I'm so grateful for the format of this book is because it's not a parenting book. It's not a how-to. I would be very ridiculous to write a parenting how-to book. 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. But it's more of just my hopes as I start out this journey and things that I hope that I can keep on the forefront of my mind as I navigate all of those different emotions and circumstances.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned in the book several times, but you live not too far from where Emmett Till was killed, right?
Yeah. 2 hours away.
And that's not that, like we pretend like that's ancient history. It's not. Mm-mm. I mean, it is so close to,
It is. I taught, this is my 8th or 9th year teaching. It's always hard to count because I took a year off after my little boy was born. And I have taught at Emmett Till more than once. After my son was born, I cried so hard. And it's one of those things where you don't have to experience something in order to be compassionate. That's one of the whole tenets of the book, because I want all kinds of people to pick it up and be compassionate. But there is something about looking into that beautiful, I mean, he's beautiful. You see his pictures and he was just this gorgeous, shiny eye little boy. And I didn't realize how young he was or how fragile he was or how beautiful he was until I had my own son. And it hit differently when I had my own son and I taught it again.
Do you mind just refreshing? Cause I'm sure there's people like off the top of their head, like maybe don't know this history that well. Can you just talk about how, I'd love to hear.
So Greenwood, Mississippi, is the cotton capital of the world. My, one of my very good friends lives there. Every time I drive there, I see the sign and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's in the Delta. And it still has the sign up that says cotton capital of the world. And I'm like, no. Every year they have the cotton ball where all these wealthy white people get together and have a ball about cotton. It's great. So next, like right next door to Greenwood is a town called Money, Mississippi. And in the 1950s, a young boy named Emmett Till, who's 14 years old, was visiting from Chicago, visiting his family in Mississippi, which happens all the time. Just this summer, we had my my husband, Philip, his young cousin from Indianapolis came and stayed with us for the summer. And all of our white friends were like, dude, that's rough. Like, you have a teenager staying with you for the summer? Like, wow, that's charity. And it's like, no, this is what black people do. Like,
it's family, this is right? Normal. That's a community.
It's it's like he's coming. Like, his dad is not at home. My husband wanted to like mentor him over the, like, it's totally normal. And so in this normal exchange of things that happens in the black community a lot, and particularly during this period, because black families would migrate up north and their parents would not want their children to forget life and culture down south. And so they'd send their kids down south for the summer. So Emmett was down for the summer and he was just talking like 14-year-old boys talk and doing his little 14-year-old thing in a grocery store. And it's hard to say what happened because later on, the white woman admitted that she was not honest about what happened. But what she said happened is that he whistled at her and said, "Hey, baby," which even if that did happen, so what? But her husband and two of his friends came, got him in the middle of the night, beat him, tied him up and threw him in the river in Money, Mississippi. They just erected a marker for the place where it happened. And it's bulletproof because people do not want it there and have already tried to deface it. But it really was the touchstone of a touchstone of the civil rights movement. His mother had an open casket funeral for him so that people could see what was done to him. Mm.
Yeah.
And
the woman later recanted everything.
Yep, she said it didn't happen. Yeah, she said it didn't happen. I think she's dead now. I think she died. Mm. But right before she died, she said, you know what? It didn't really happen like that, the way that I said that it did, which is horrible in and of itself.
Yeah.
And also, even if it had happened,
yeah,
was not worth right. the loss of this young boy's life.
Yeah, it's a life. Yeah, this is life.
Yeah, it's a life. If he's 14, and even if he did do something stupid, which history tells us that maybe he didn't even.
Right.
It's not worth what happened to him.
Yeah, yeah. And we get into a big sanctity of life issue there. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, African Americans at that time and in some people's minds today are not considered equal in life,
yeah.
right? Their lives yeah. are not yeah. as valuable as whites and yeah.
Yeah, because it's always like he brought it on himself,
right?
Whether it's the prison industrial complex
right.
or the
right.
war on drugs or yeah. they brought it on themselves. So right. it's a very like pull yourselves up by your bootstraps mentality, which is unfortunate. But I always think about like if the story were different and that had happened to a little white boy over whistling and winking at a woman.
Right.
I mean, that sinks differently for a lot of people. And then my question is, why does it sink differently for right. you now?
Yeah. Because yeah. it's contrary to everything that the Bible is about, right? From mm-hmm. the very beginning, it is like people are created in God's image. There's no two ways yeah. about it, right?
Yes, yes. And justice should always be, it should be restorative
yeah.
as much as humanly possible. Yeah. And that's not the world that we're living in.
Right. Very much so. I keep running into people, my parents' age and my parents included, who went to school when it was segregated. Like they were literally in high school in segregated schools.
Yeah.
And then we want to yeah. talk about how like all this stuff is ancient history. I'm like, I'm not sure like where you're getting all of that.
It's crazy. My mom grew up in Dallas and she told the story when I was a kid of a friend of her older brother's who had a motorcycle. He felt too fancy in it. And so a group of white kids poured gasoline on him and lit him on fire on his motorcycle. And when she told us the story, like it just seemed like such a long time ago, but right. that was in the 70s.
Yeah. That's yeah. That's not that long ago.
No, not at all. And you always right. like you think of like, oh, like the 50s and 60s with civil rights and then everything was fine. It's like, no, yeah. no, we're no. still groaning over change, just like slavery did in the 1860s. And then everything was not fine. Like right. there's a, I don't know, a learning curve. And I think that we're still learning.
Yeah. So how do we go about like having healthy conversations? Because you mentioned in the book, like that is not your natural predisposition, right? To like,
yeah,
like you stayed
yeah.
silent for a long time and didn't have these conversations.
Yes.
So
yes.
let's have the conversation then. Like why?
Yeah.
Why now and how, I guess.
Yeah. I am one of the most non-confrontational people ever, which my husband thinks is hilarious because I'm not non-confrontational with him. Like, why'd you say to me? But it's because I feel super safe with him.
Yeah,
I know my
right.
husband loves
yeah.
me. And so I feel like I can, you know, but growing up as a pastor's kid and living in a glass house and having a lot of trust issues, people who should have felt safe to me didn't feel safe. And so it was always a matter of walking on eggshells so that I wouldn't offend somebody and also just wouldn't reflect badly on my dad. I cannot tell you as a pastor's kid how many times things that I did were used against my dad. Silly things.
Yeah.
And so I just was very like, oh, I don't want to rock the boat. Like, want to keep my dad safe, want to keep our family safe. And so I guess I know that that was a huge part of it growing up. And it wasn't until I got married to my husband and we moved to Mississippi and something happened. And a friend of mine was like, oh, we know Jasmine and Philip, they just have crazy black monkey sex.
What?
And a friend of mine, like a really close friend of mine. And I didn't say anything. And it was like, that was like the one, like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm.
Where I was like, hey, let's talk about the hypersexualization of Black bodies for a second, because that's a real thing.
Right. Yes.
And it was one of my first times ever saying something. And I think because it went so well, my friend was like super receptive and very like, you know, I think like homeschoolers, when homeschoolers try to be edgy, it doesn't, it just, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're not practiced in it. So it's like, oh, no, baby, what are you doing? So we had like a whole conversation and it went really well. Mm-hmm. And I think that was like a pivotal point where I was like, you know what? I can speak up for myself. And the people who actually are safe in love with the love of Christ and are mature enough to walk in that, I can continue to have relationship and continue to have hard conversations. And so it kind of started a journey for me of learning how to have difficult conversations and learning how to stick up for myself and realizing that I was going to have to stick up for my son. Because people saying something to me is one thing. People looking at my son a certain way is another. And so the mama bear was born. Yeah. And
right. as well as she should be, right? I mean, that's your job. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And as he was born, just watching him grow up, like something just broke inside of me. And I was like, you know, the dam really. And I was like, you know, we can't do this. And I don't have to do this. This is not what I'm called to as a Christian. Like I'm called to have difficult conversations with people that offend me. I'm not called to like ride out on people and cancel people every 5 minutes, but that's not what having a difficult conversation has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because we live in cancel culture, right? And you mentioned Twitter in your book, and like literally, I can't get my head wrapped around Twitter because it feels like that all the time. Like I try so hard.
I've had so many people, my friends who are writers, like, Jasmine, you got to tweet more. Right. Like you got to tweet more, and I'm like, but I just like every time I tweet, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I going to get in trouble for this?
I don't know what to say.
What are all the ways? I know. I'm like, what are all the ways that this can blow up in my face? And why am I an expert on everything just because I have a Twitter account? Right, I don't know what's going on in every aspect of the world or the election or the...
Right. And trying to be nuanced on a platform that specifically does not allow for nuance. You know,
no, it's supposed to be reactionary. Like, retweet it. Like it. Yeah. Just like everything's firing at you all the time. And it's just, it's so funny. My friend is really into the Enneagram, like super into the Enneagram. And she was like, when I read your book, it was like an introverted Enneagram 5 trying her best to speak very slowly and very softly so as not to be misunderstood. And I was like, yes.
Interesting.
I can see that. And that's kind of like the fear of my tweeting is like, I want to speak very slowly and very softly so as not to be misunderstood. And people are still going to misunderstand you. You can't control that. But as much as I can control it, I really do try.
Right. Because, I mean, we follow a relational God at the same time, right? Who calls us to relationship with him, but like also relationships with others.
And I think
relationships can't be formed in 140 characters necessarily, right? Like a relationship needs back and forth, and it needs, you know, it needs willing to step into sort of the hard things, you know? And I think that's what
it's hard to do on Twitter.
Any social media really, right?
More
so on Twitter. I just like Instagram. Sure. I post beautiful pictures of my amazing kids and like just talk about how awesome they are, right? It's like Instagram, you know, I can get down with that. It's fine.
I love that. Post pictures of my kids, post pictures of my plants. We're good.
Exactly. We're like fine. Who needs more than that, right? If you want to have a conversation with me, then call me or, you know. But yeah, no, it's difficult. And I think it's difficult to, and something you highlight in this book is like a mother, a Black mother talking to her son about like living in this culture that is so against him already, like from the outset.
Yes. And, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. Obviously I enjoyed the book. It really is a beautifully written book.
Thank you so much.
I mean that. I do. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it's inspiring in a lot of ways. I know writing is a it's a discovery process, right? Like, what did you discover sort of as you, you know, wrote this book?
Can I tell you the hardest chapter to write?
Yeah, sure.
Was the one on politics. I am such an emotional writer. When something is not working, I delete it. I don't like work with it and like mold it. I'm just like, forget it. I deleted that chapter, like all of the words in the chapter, no less than three times.
Wow.
'Cause I was just like, I would get to the end of it and I'd be like, that's not right.
Yeah, right.
Just turn over. My husband's like, just keep the pieces. And I'm like, no. The pieces are no good. We can't piece it together. It has to be like a letter, which is like written from beginning to end. Like it has to work.
Yeah.
And the reason I think why that chapter was so hard is because there were so many things that I wanted to say and so many things that I wanted to get into that were not the main point that I was trying to get across. And so I think what the book did was it distilled the things that I am most passionate about, and it distilled the truths that I am most passionate about communicating. What I'm most proud of is that so much of what it distilled is the gospel, which is praise God.
Yeah.
Praise God. But there's other pieces that it distilled too, like my love of Langston Hughes and my love of birth and my love of my boys and my love of my husband. And so it's a really intimate book, which again is hilarious because I'm an introvert. So I have all these people who live in Jackson now. They like come over to my house for book club and they're like, I've read your book. I'm like, don't talk to me.
Well, it is even like, I read this book over this past week and it's like, I spent all of this time with you. You know what I mean? And like,
it
is a very intimate, you know, there's a knowledge of you that you put out in this book. It's vulnerable.
It's vulnerable. Which is, it's such a, what's interesting about it is that it's all the stuff that I wish that people knew about everybody so that we could like love each other better.
Amen.
Do you know what
I
mean?
Yeah.
Like all of this stuff that makes up all of my background and all of this stuff that makes up all of my baggage and all of this stuff that makes up all the good things about me and all of the not so good things about me is put into perspective in the book. And that is a perspective that I wish that we could all have on each other. Like just the knowledge and understanding of each other that cushions the blow of hard conversation.
Yeah, right. Very much so. Because when you, and that's what the pod, I mean, that's what this podcast is. It's story, right? And like,
yeah.
There's value to all of our stories and we all come at things from our perspective.
Absolutely.
Because that's all we have.
Right? Absolutely. Like,
oh, that brings up one important point. Did I let you finish the previous thought?
Oh, no. That's okay. Good. Yeah.
Okay. I just get, you know, I got so excited because I wanted to, something you brought out in the book that I've never heard anyone ever talk about. Is ignorance. Because you handle it in like a really nuanced way because ignorance is said with such vitriol in our culture. And it's not like, it's not anything. I mean, that's not what it's about. So do you mind just talking a little bit about that?
Yes. I have had so many conversations with people where it's like, you know, the hard thing about talking cross-culturally with Black people is that so many times they treat us like we're ignorant of their culture. And I'm like, well, you are.
Yeah.
I'm ignorant of a lot of cultures.
Right. Right.
It's okay. Like I grew up, growing up, I had friends whose grandparents were from Mexico. So their parents had grown up in like entirely Spanish-speaking household. And so when I would go over to their house, there would be like Spanish flying everywhere. And I would be like, I don't know. Or they would talk about, like, they talk about food. They talk about all of these things. And I would just be like, I don't know. That's not a reflection on me. I'm just not Mexican. That's okay.
Yeah.
What's not okay is for me to walk into their house and make judgments about their culture and the way that they do family life without an understanding of who they are and how they operate. What's not okay is for me to go into their house and act like the authority on their culture just because I'm in their house. But what is okay is for me to just, you can't know what you don't know. And that's an opportunity to learn. It doesn't necessarily have to be an epithet to hear that you may be ignorant of someone's culture and that somebody else might have something to teach you.
Right.
I've learned that so many times just as a teacher of eighth graders, my students, they are ignorant.
Right. Yeah.
But nobody expects an eighth grader not to be.
Right.
And yeah. I think that if we had that same expectation sometimes of adults, then conversations would go a lot better.
They would. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's okay to be ignorant. It's not okay, it's okay to like stay in that ignorance, right? Like
exactly.
We learn exactly. And grow. Mm-hmm. And
it's like, oh, okay. Well, teach me. I didn't know that. Teach yeah. me. Or I've had, you know, people, I've had friends ask me things. I have, my hair has a name. Its name is Wild Mike. It is, has its own personality. It is on top of my head, but I'm not in charge of it. It just it does what it's going to do. And I just let it do what it's going to do. And I've had friends be like, so like, when you say he has his own personality, like, what do you mean? Like, what products do you use? Or like, how often do you wash it? Or how often do you, those questions, that those don't offend me.
Yeah.
As long as it's not a stranger off the street, you know, it's a person yeah. who loves me and just wants to understand something about me. They are ignorant of my hair. That's
yeah.
okay. There's right. aspects of their hair that I'm very ignorant of as well. What is it?
Sure.
What is a serum? Why are you blow drying it every day?
Right.
Why are you washing it so often? Like, just help me. Like,
right.
I feel like there's not that give and take of you're allowed not to know something about somebody else's culture. What you're not allowed to do is assume that you do know
right.
and act like you're an authority on it.
Right. Because there's a humility to admitting ignorance, right?
Yeah.
Like an inherent.
Of course.
Yeah. And one thing we do not have enough of in our world is just like straight up humility, right? And so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just not knowing. There's so many times like my students have asked me, I don't remember what they asked me about. They ask me questions all the time because they think that I know everything. I teach medieval history.
Wait, did you say medieval?
Medieval history. I teach medieval history. I teach at a classical school. So
okay.
This year has been medieval history. Last year was ancient history and medieval history. So they'll ask me something about one, like Charlemagne's son, Lothair, or his grandson, Lothair. Like, what's up with him? Why did he have a different mother than me? And I'm just like, I hate this. I don't know. I'll tell you tomorrow. Let me go home. And I will. I go home and I'll do some research. And I'll come back and I'll be like, here's a line of, and so they see, like, even though I'm an adult and even though I'm their teacher, I don't know everything there is to know about French bloodlines, but I can find out.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's good. I appreciate you jumping into that. This interview flew by.
It did.
So many other questions I could ask you, but I think we probably should jump into the final two questions, if that's okay with you.
Of course, yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I haven't had a lot of jobs. Let's see. Oh, I tell you a strange job story.
Okay, I love it.
I worked for my dad. He writes books, and during the age before MP3s were all that in the bag of ham sandwiches, he sold CDs. So I would like package them up and sell them. And I would work customer service, which is hilarious because, as previously discussed, very introverted. Picked up the phone one time and this guy on the other end went, oh my gosh, are you Jasmine? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, oh my gosh, I think about you all the time. And I was like, okay. That year he came to our church's conference and was like, do you remember me from the phone? I still think about you all the time.
Tell me you got a restraining order.
Weirdest work interaction ever. Like, weirdest work interaction ever. So not the job itself, but like that. Wow. Definitely really in real life did happen.
That's real talk right there. That is
my dad wrote books about biblical manhood and womanhood, and there were a lot of pastors who would write him and be like, hey, I know that you care about biblical manhood and womanhood. I'm a biblical man. I hear you have a daughter. And my dad would be like, I do, but no.
What?
Yes. In real life.
I don't even have okay. words. I don't have
it's
words.
Fun stories. It's fun time.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. A pastor's kid. You never really know, do you?
You never know what you're gonna get.
Arranged marriage, who knows, you know?
Let's see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. That's a good one. So then my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
That's a good question. Realizing that their work is not the end. Their work is a means to an end, which is to bring glory to God. And I say this as a woman who, you know, I am a writer part-time and I am a teacher actually part-time, but I spend a lot of time at home and I spend a lot of time, like if you could see behind the camera right now, I have like a pot, like laundry, just like folded towels and baskets of clothes over there. I was cleaning up the kitchen before I got on. And all of those little aspects can seem so mundane, but the way that I'm bringing God's kingdom into my work is realizing that I'm a part of his kingdom and the work that I do is good and it's for his glory and it's for the advancement of his name. In my case, it's for my home and it's for my children and it's for my husband. And in someone else's case, whatever they're doing, to bring good in the world and to bring, just good to other people can be the work of God.
Yeah. Amen. That's good stuff. Jasmine, thanks for taking time for me. And now you can get back to, you know, that other stuff that you're doing.
Hold that laundry.
That's right. That's right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, thanks y'all for checking out the episode. I'm glad you, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Jasmine. And I just think the topics we covered in this were so hope filled. And at the same time, there was like a lot of depth to it. And her book is very much that way. I encourage you to check it out. It's a really easy read, but one that I think you will have to digest quite a bit at the same time. It has both of those aspects to it. So yeah, and encourage you to check it out. You can find that on the IVP website or wherever you buy your books. And I would just appreciate you sharing this episode with your friends. I think that hope is good for us all, and everybody needs a little bit of laughter, and I think you find that in this episode. So you can also scroll down to the bottom of your iTunes app right now. You can rate and review the episode there. That's always very helpful for getting the word out about A Theology of Hustle. I hope your quarantine is going well, and I hope you're finding amazing things to do, amazing time with friends and family during this time. So until next week, get out there and hustle. Or maybe rather more appropriately, stay in and hustle. However you need to hustle these next weeks, do that. So we'll see you next time.